Hello, listeners. Welcome to episode number 7 of In Conversation with Ashwin, and this is your host, Ashwin. Today's discussion is entrepreneurship. That's the theme of discussion, and I couldn't get a more befitting guest. Pranshu Maheshwari has formed 3 companies in 5 years now. He's raised $1 million for one of his startups, and he's 24 or 25 years old. In fact, I met him at a party recently where we got discussing his most recent company and how he's been doing really crazy things. So I was so inspired post our conversation that I said, hey, we should definitely get you on the show, and I really want to learn more about your journey and the things that you've been up to. So yes, we did it today. He came over, I recorded this in person to tell you a little about Pranshu. He grew up in Chennai. He went to Wharton for college. He originally dreamed of going into politics in India after college, idealistic dreams of changing the country and all that. He started his first company in second year, retail analytics using cameras. It was called Prayas Analytics. We actually talk about that in our chat. It got funded by Y Combinator, raised $1 million. But then he had to shut the product down in 2016 for a bunch of reasons. Returned the money back to the investors and came back to India in September 2016 and started Simple Money. To tell you simply in one line what Simple Money is about, it tracks your portfolio automatically by reading the statements in your inbox. In our conversation, we discuss his early childhood, his passion for building relevant institutions, his learnings in Wharton Business School, his learnings from startups. He talks about funding, how to approach it, and when it is a good time to raise money for a company. Specifically, we also talk about his startup Simple Money, which tracks your portfolio automatically by reading the statements in your inbox, as I just mentioned. We discuss his favorite books, minimalism, and even discuss our mutual love for renowned organizational psychologist and Wharton professor, and also one of my favoritest authors, Adam Grant. So without further ado, presenting to you my wide-ranging conversation with Pranshu Maheshwari. In fact, most of the books we bring up, the TV shows he mentions, and also another great Medium post that Pranshu has written about his 10 learnings from entrepreneurship so far are in the show notes. You can find it in the description box on whichever platform you're listening on. So yes, hope you guys enjoy this conversation as much as I did. Hi Pranshu, welcome to the show. Thank you for taking the time to join us.
Thank you, man. Excited for this.
Cool. First question, which is mostly the same question I ask all my guests. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little about your early childhood and how that has ended up having an influence on the person that you've become and are becoming.
Oh, man. It's a deep beginning. I don't know about how much of my early childhood has influenced where I am right now. I think as far as like making direct links between my early childhood and what I'm doing today, like I remember my favorite things as a child being building things. And it was never just building things that I could use or play with myself. It was always building things that I could show to other people. I was one of those kids who grew up with like millions of boxes of Legos around me. I was one of those kids who grew up with like every scrap of paper in the house would have something scribbled on. Every piece of the wall had something that I had scribbled on.
Yeah.
And all I could think about, man, my whole life, as far as I can remember, was just build something, show it to someone, build something, show it to someone. And at some point in like school, in like somewhere around 9th or 10th, it turned into, I actually really want to build institutions, as big a word as that sounds, where I don't want the things I build to be a toy that I play with. I want to build a culture.
Yeah.
I want to build people who believe in something that I believe in as well. And yeah. I want to get people motivated to do the same thing and build the same thing that I'm building.
Yeah.
And what's funny is that for most of my life, until like maybe my second year of college, I kept thinking that all of that led to politics in India.
Yeah.
And something that you would probably know from like, I don't know if you remember from like when we had met way
yeah,
back.
Yeah, we did, yeah.
But
I
it
remember
was like,
your dreams of, I think, making it into the political scenario, yeah. Changing things at the grassroots level.
I don't know. I mean, which I think is like a very idealistic dream that anyone in India of our age with some degree of idealism hopes for at some point.
Yeah, yeah.
But very specifically with me, it was like, and I love building institutions. What's the most important institution in the world? Surely it's a political institution. Let's fix India's political institutions. And that's all I could think about until like my second year of college.
This was when you were in UPenn?
This was when I was in UPenn. This was when I was in school. All I could think about was, man, I just want to build institutions.
Yeah. How was school for you in Chennai? How was it growing up in Chennai?
Really interesting. I mean, I think so. I went to Shishya, which is, it's not a very academic school, even though I was a very academic person, and I still am.
Yeah.
I was definitely very much the class nerd, but I didn't mind it. You know, I didn't mind being in that position. It was
Yeah,
fun.
yeah.
I had enough people who I liked. I had enough people who liked me, fortunately, which I think is a little more important. And I got the chance to do a lot of cool things. You know, so if you, I had a bunch of formative experiences at school. You know, organizing our school culturals and model UN conferences and stuff like that. It was where I got my first taste of real institution building. And I remember to this day, like some of the things that I'm actually most proud of having built in life are actually things that are still being used at our school today for the Model UN, for the school culturals, things that we had put in place, well, no, 8, 9 years ago, 10 years
Wow.
ago, that are still getting used. And I think it goes to show that when you put things in place through an institution that are valid, you can have relevance well beyond your time in that institution.
Yeah.
And that was really inspiring to me. So.
I like that thought. Leaving a legacy behind.
It is, yeah. It is a little bit of leaving legacy behind. A little bit of it is just being relevant. I mean, I feel like as human beings, we're constantly in a search for relevance, right?
Yeah.
Like, how can we define ourselves in life as doing something that is not totally futile until the day we die?
Yeah.
Or, on the other hand of it, how do we distract ourselves from the futility of life until we die?
Yeah.
And it's like, for me, the answer has always ended up being build an institution that seems pretty fun. It seems like the most distracting thing to do.
Love it, love it. I think this is the first question, and I feel like it's a great start, and I love the fact that we've jumped directly into the really important things, skipping the superficial ones. Okay, so next question. Tell us a little about Wharton. What got you into starting up? For listeners who are not aware, Pranshu is an entrepreneur. I would have already recorded this in the pre-introduction, but still, he's founded three companies along the way since he started college. So yes, tell us what got you into starting up.
Yeah, so I don't think I would have gotten into startups if it hadn't been for a friend of mine who I met at college, who I ended up starting my first company with. And so until this point in my life, right, like I said, all I'd been thinking about was politics. I get into Wharton, and Wharton is a very finance school, right? It's quote unquote an economics degree, but it's really a business degree, and the culture is very financial heavy. It is basically a direct pipeline to Wall Street, right? Like, you get onto Wharton, you get into hedge funds, you get into investment banking, you get into the world of high and mighty finance. And somewhere along the way at Wharton, I discovered the finance passion that I didn't discover beforehand in my life. And so then, my first couple of years at Wharton, all I was thinking was, man, hedge funds, hedge funds, hedge funds, this is all I want to do. Until I met this friend of mine who was really into tech and startups. His name is Yash. He was who I started my first company with. And he was really into tech and startups. We met on a rock climbing trip, got really
Nice.
close. He was someone who I connected with very deeply in terms of the way we looked at the world. And he very wisely realized that that was the right kind of person he wanted in a co-founder. For some reason, he thought that I knew how to code. And
Did
he.
you? No.
I mean, what you could learn in a week, that's about it. And he decided that, you know what, man, this guy supposedly knows how to code. We
Yeah.
get along really well.
Yeah.
I want to start a tech company. I'm going to ask him if he wants to join me. And I honestly didn't think of it very seriously at the time, right? Like, at the time, I was just thinking of it, man, you know, this seems like another interesting project to work on. It'll look good on my resume, if nothing else. It was very mercantile.
Yeah.
And there wasn't much passion behind it until we started working on it. And then it was really fun. And it
Yeah.
came back down to the same thing as before, which is we're building something. This could have relevance to more people than just us. Through this, we can build an organization and an institution of people who believe in the same things that we believe in.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's how it got started.
Awesome, awesome. Okay, tell us a little more about Prius Analytics. Like, what does
Yeah.
it do? And just maybe a rundown of a minute or two on how what the use case
Yeah,
was.
yeah, yeah. What did it do? We've
Yeah.
sat down now. So the first thing to note is that the name is a combination of my name and my co-founder's name.
Yeah,
So
yeah.
Pranshu plus Yash Prayas,
Got it.
which
Which is awesome.
it
And
is
Prayas
awesome.
actually means something,
It
right?
does, right? Like, it's like, yeah, you can use it as a verb, which means like to work really hard. And
Yeah.
then as a noun, it's like a great endeavor. So
Well,
it's an awesome word. Except
okay.
Americans pronounced it as pray as, which just doesn't
Pray
see
as?
pray as, which just
Yeah. Oh,
doesn't
pray
sound
as
as
again.
nice. So
Yeah.
pray as Analytics was a retail technology company, and we built software that analyzed security camera footage to give a retailer basically an offline version of Google Analytics. So Amazon, for instance, can tell you clicked on these five items, you looked at this item, you put that item in your cart, and finally you bought this other thing. We were basically giving physical retailers the same thing. And if you ask me why we started that and why we did that, honestly, again, there was just the answer is that we were 19 years old and naive. It was a cool idea. We wanted to start a company. It seemed plausible. And I mean, even saying it out loud right now, right? Like, the pitch makes sense, which is, Online retailers have data, offline retailers don't. Let's give offline retailers the same amount of data.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, the product just didn't work for a whole bunch of reasons, right? Like, so we actually managed to get the tech to work. I did eventually learn to code beyond just 1 week's worth of computer science education.
Yeah.
And we
Was this during your class or outside of
it? No, this was outside. This was all outside. So this was my second year of college, for perspective, yeah. Right? I think the first 1 year we did what every entrepreneur, quote-unquote entrepreneur, does in their first 1 year, which is they think about starting a company and then they think about all these unnecessary things that they're going to do without actually working on the product.
Yeah.
About my fourth year, we realized that was stupid, and we started really working on the product, trying to get customers, going out and selling to people. And the technology worked, and still to this day, it's some of the most fascinating technology I've ever worked on. The issue was it became a science project because the product itself wasn't that good. And this was one of my first lessons as an entrepreneur, which is that technology, I think, as fascinating as it can be, in the end is a means to an end, which is your technology has to do something that people want. If your technology can do something that people want, it's great. If not, it turns out to be a science project. So in our case, right, the reason why Prayas was a science project was retailers just didn't know what to do with this kind of data, right? So, okay, I had 100% of my customers walked in through the front door, 50% walked through the shelf on the left, 40% to the, you know, the shelf on the right. Great, what do I do? And we could never answer that question. We just couldn't tell them. We just assumed that, okay, we give them this data, they'll figure out what to do, and they didn't know what to do with it. And we had no idea how to do anything in retail. We didn't have the passion for retail, we didn't have the domain knowledge in retail, so we had no clue what to do either, and that's just what ultimately led the product to fail.
Right.
And I think at a more meta level, it was just founder product fit, which is you need to be deeply passionate about the problem you're solving.
Yeah.
If you're not deeply passionate about it, it'll fail for a whole multitude of reasons. And in our case, it was a lack of domain knowledge. And I mean, I'm sure we could have made the product useful if we tried for long enough, but we just didn't want to.
Yeah.
Right? The motivation was missing. Why are we solving this problem?
Yeah.
I don't like retail. I have no connection to retail at all, right? Like, in fact, I actively dislike retail. I think people should be buying less, not more.
Yeah, consumerism is
just
a growing disease.
Yeah, exactly, right? It is a growing disease, right? And to me, retail is very much the opposite of how I try to live my life. And here we were trying to build software for retailers.
Yeah.
I mean, there was no way this would work on a motivation and a personal level.
Absolutely. Got it. Oh, interesting. So let's talk about your startup, Simple Money. Since you got back, you've been working on it for more than a year now. How's that going? How did it happen? What is it about?
Yeah, so I'll go in a bit of background about how Prayas ended, which is helpful, which is, so Prayas went through Y Combinator in, 2015 summer. So we get into YC 2 weeks before graduation, which is great because we didn't have any money at the point. We didn't know how
Y Combinator is an incubator, an accelerator.
It's a startup accelerator, and it's really well known. It was one of the first venture capital arms that launched the accelerator model.
Yeah.
I mean, in the end, I mean, accelerators are just venture capitalists, but with a different model. And these guys were the first people to do it.
Yeah.
And it's pretty prestigious at this point and pretty well known.
Absolutely.
And it was
they're everywhere.
Yeah, and it was a big deal for us to get into them, right? And I think it was a big stamp of approval for everyone around us who might have doubted us to say, okay, well, I guess they're onto something if YC cared. And to this day, I don't know why they cared. I mean,
just Pran should be humble.
No, but you know, like, you at least in my mind, it was so clear that, well, it's clear now, I guess. Maybe it wasn't clear then, but at least in my mind now, it's so clear that there was not a good fit between the founders and the product they were trying to build. I don't know why anyone would have ever invested in it. But not only did we raise money from Y Combinator, we raised a seed round of $1 million, which probably only happened because we had the YC stamp attached to us, right? Like
500 startups, is that?
500 startups had a seed fund that they invested in us with, a fund called Birchmere Ventures out of Pittsburgh, a few other people, a few of our professors from Wharton. And so things were going, I mean, in superficial terms, going fine at this point, right? Like there were articles every couple of weeks in the press about this hot YC startup doing all of this stuff. It hit all the buzzwords at the time, right? Big data, artificial intelligence, computer vision, offline retail analytics. And it's just, this is 2015, right? These are all the buzzwords that are everywhere
it
in business
publications. It still is. And lots of people just use it out of their ass. Like they don't even know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
Artificially AI.
But you know what the sad thing is? We didn't either. And we were supposedly building a product in this space.
Got it.
Which goes to show, right? Fake it till you make it. And some people just keep faking it. And, you know, all of this had to collapse at some point. And in the end, we got a lot of pilot clients. A lot of large American retailers used our software and tried it out, and then didn't buy the full version of it because it just wasn't useful.
Yeah.
And this happened multiple times. And come 2016, January or February, Yash and I are in a meeting in Portland, Maine, which is a beautiful place, but it's cold. There's literally a blizzard outside, right? We're both sick and with runny noses and red eyes. We come back from a meeting with a client, and this man, this just sucks. Nobody's buying it. There's been no growth. We haven't learned anything in the last 7 months. We should do something else. We should shut this down. And we shut it down. I mean, it was actually the second we realized that shutting it down was an option, it was like a weight had been lifted off our shoulders. And we shut it down. And we decided we're going to keep trying a few ideas because we still wanted to be entrepreneurs. And about 6 weeks into that process, Yash decided that he wanted to move on from the company because I think he was just burnt out at this point with startup life. And a realization that we had both come to at around this time was that we don't know enough about the world to really be starting companies. At least we hadn't seen enough problems in the world that we could start a company around. Yash was very motivated actually by problems in the more social spectrum of things, which is why he ended up joining a nonprofit where he's still working today.
Nice.
And in my case, I just kept trying out different ideas. For about 4 months in there, I operated as a data science consultancy basically. And got sick of that eventually, shut that down. So that was the second company. And in a fit of anger, came back to India with about 2 days' notice. September 2016. So the idea for Simple Money had been bobbing around in my head for a bit, right? And I built version one and I showed it to my dad, and dad's like, "Oh, this is cool actually. I'd use it." And he actually did start using it. And
What does your dad do for background?
yeah, so for background, so my parents are financial planners.
Awesome.
And they manage money on behalf of a bunch of clients. And they're in a new space in India of fee-only financial planning, which means instead of a financial planner getting a commission from the products that they sell you, my parents charge a consultant fee and then give you products that don't have a sales commission attached.
Well, so direct.
Yes, exactly. Direct mutual funds. They've started doing some equities as well. And they have over 100 clients now. And so my parents were doing this, and they were managing all of this on Excel spreadsheets at the time, right? So massive 40 to 50 page Excel spreadsheets with all of this incredible programming that I still to date is more incredible a technological feat than anything I have built, because my dad managed to get those Excel spreadsheets to look like a fully featured application,
Wow.
which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
But they were Excel
Excel
spreadsheets,
spreadsheets,
right? And so they have all the issues that come with that. So I built version one of Simple Money. Simple Money, for background, is a portfolio tracker that works by reading the statements that you get in your email. So it'll track your mutual funds, it'll track your stock investments. Hopefully in the near future, it'll track a
I'm
lot
actually
more.
a user of Simple Money, and it's pretty cool. I got talking about it with Pranshu at a party, and right then, right when we finished our conversation, I already had most of my mutual funds and stocks tracked via Simple Money. So I definitely recommend you get on it too. Yeah, it's
Thank
free
you.
for now at least,
It is
right?
free for now. It's going to be free till April, and there will always be a free version of it. But
Okay, so yeah, sorry you got you off.
No,
Go for it.
of course. It's always good to hear people liking the product. So so I send version one to my dad. My dad loves it and starts using it, and I just decide, man, my life in America right now isn't great. I am failing at every business I start. I haven't made any money in a really long time, and it's just like I'm really frustrated at this. I've been an entrepreneur now 3 years at this point, 3 years. I have nothing to show for it. All of like four people ever have used anything I've built. All right, one last shot. Gonna go to India. Gonna go back home.
Figure
Build
something out.
something, try to see if it works. Came back home literally like 2 days after making this decision. I mean, I booked the first flight I could find.
Wow.
Came
That
back
is a
home.
bold move.
I mean, I would never do it again, but I'm very glad I did it at the time. I really needed it, right? And it kind of invigorated me in a lot of ways, which was just the stupidity and the craziness of it, I think, made me realize that sometimes in life, perceived risk is far greater than actual risk. The net is much higher up than we think when we make a jump off a cliff, you know? And this was the first, well, I mean, this was one of many times
Wow.
in my life when I've learned this lesson, but like, this was the most clear one to me,
Those are
right?
literally words to write down. I think after the recording, I'm going to actually take them. Yeah, makes so much
I
sense.
hope those are my words. I'm sure I have read them somewhere and I'm now plagiarizing, but
Subconsciously
yeah,
plagiarizing,
I'm very sure I'm doing that. So came back to India and spent the next 2.5 weeks just building out a real version one of the product. And 2.5 weeks later, my dad has one, like a fully featured, beautiful product in his hands. He starts sending it around to his friends, and they start sending it to their friends. And the almost stereotypical aha moment shows up when it's like not only are people telling their friends about it, but they are using it every day. They're coming back to it. They are finding enough value in it to send me an email when things are broken. And I was like, oh, this is the first time in my life anybody has ever found value out of, well, I mean, first time in my entrepreneurial life when somebody has found value out of something I built. I should stick with this. And about, I had made myself a promise that by December, if it wasn't working, I was going to quit, stop being an entrepreneur, call it a day on the startup dream. But I think by about December, by about, you know, October, November, there were enough signs that this could work. Enough optimism had started coming back into me that this could work. And I don't want to say it's been smooth sailing since then. It's certainly not. But it's been way smoother than any of the other ventures have been. And it's a wonderful feeling sometimes to wake up in the morning to angry emails from people because the product didn't work well, because it means they're invested. There's now thousands of people using Simple Money. We've still never spent any money on marketing.
Wow.
It's all just growing because people talk about it, and that's an incredible feeling.
Awesome. I feel like it's a great concept, and I like the word, name Simple Money.
Yeah.
It is simple, like.
I'm amazed the domain was available.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so got lucky on that one.
Okay, let's talk about funding. Your startup Brass Analytics
Yeah.
received $1 million in funding. How
Yeah.
did you approach funding? What are the lessons that you would give to today's entrepreneurs on approaching VCs or accelerators?
Oh man, so many lessons here. So I think Prayas shouldn't have raised money.
Okay.
I'm glad we did because we're still running off of that money today, effectively.
Yeah.
So when we gave money back to all our investors, we offered every investor the chance to take their money back,
Yeah.
whatever was left of it, which was a lot. I mean, we didn't spend much. And all of them, except for a couple, YC and 500 Startup Seed Fund, took it back. And
Wow.
so I've effectively been running off of that money from those two investors for the last 3.5 years.
That's good.
Still running off of it. But so it's weird for me to say that I don't think we should have raised money, but I really don't think we should have raised money. The
Why is
only
that?
reason we did it was everyone was doing it around us. Why? Because we weren't growing, right? Like, I think there are situations in which companies should raise money. If you are doing reasonably okay, so let's say at the seed stage, right? Like, you need money to survive. You should raise just enough money to survive while you can get your product to a stage where you have evidence that somebody wants it. In the B2C space, that means somebody recommends it to a friend and keeps coming back to use it. In the B2B space, you have to have revenue. If none of those things have happened, don't even bother raising money, right?
So no money, don't ask money.
I think so, because like that's a good way, that's a good way of putting it, because it's very easy to get caught up in the VC death trap, right? And when I say the VC death trap, I mean what happens with a lot of companies is that they don't have enough evidence of what they're doing is working. They acquire users by buying them, effectively. You advertise, you spend 100 rupees to acquire a user that is only worth 5. Your growth numbers might look good, but you're bleeding money. In order for you to get your next round of funding, you need to keep growing. But the only way for you to grow is to spend more money. And so you have to spend more money to raise more money. And you just keep going into that debt trap until somebody at some point realizes, wait, this company is never going to be profitable. This company is never going to mean anything. And then it all comes collapsing down. With Prayas, we just didn't have growth. We didn't have growth. We shouldn't have raised money. I kind of wonder now if we did, if we did it with the right intentionality, which was, at the time, we just thought, man, everyone's raising money. We should
But
raise
19
money.
years in Nave probably led you to
Well,
do
we
it,
were
right?
21 at this point,
Oh,
so I
yeah.
can't say, but it was still Nave. But yeah, so you know, so there's that. I think the other side of it as well is that people raise money and look at raising money as a stepping stone in startup success. There are a certain category of companies that should raise venture capital. Venture capital is a very peculiar form of investment, right? Like, these funds are looking for the next Google or Facebook, and the very reason why they're doing that is, you take a venture capital fund which has about $20 million to invest. Out of those $20 million, let's say they make 20 investments, right? 19 of those 20 investments will fail. One has to return the value of the entire fund. And so having a small success, like let's say you get an investment for that values you at $5 million and you get acquired for 6.5, actually doesn't make much money for the VC, and it makes no sense for it to happen. So they need moonshots. You know, they're very much looking for the billion-dollar companies. So when you raise venture capital from a fund, you're getting into that contract that you're going to be in it for the long haul.
You're going to be the next Google.
You're going to try. Yeah, you're at least going to try. And I think that's certainly a good thing to do for a lot of kinds of companies. It's certainly a good thing to aim for if you're the kind of person that wants to aim for it, but it requires some careful thought and intentionality. I think most people jump into it without realizing that's what they're getting into. And we certainly made that mistake the first time around. And it's probably not one that I'm going to make again in my life.
Interesting. What else funding lessons that you would give to entrepreneurs? How do you approach people to fund you?
Yeah, so we
do
got...
Do you cold email them or how do you do it?
You can. Okay. We got spoiled because so the way all accelerators work is they have a quote-unquote demo day at the end. And demo day is basically you pitch to a whole room of investors and you talk to them after and then you take it from there. YC's demo day, YC being YC, the demo day is very well attended with all of the big name investors there. And it scales the fundraising process really well because instead of you going out now to try to contact 1,000 venture capitalists...
They contact you.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so we started off at demo day. We got a bunch of intros to people from there. A bunch of people approached us afterwards. And we were lucky to raise some money from that. Raising money is difficult because everybody... Investors are driven by two things, right? They're driven by the fear of losing money. But in the venture capital world, very specifically, they are driven by the fear of missing out on the next Google. FOMO is basically really the only thing that you can use to get investors to jump money at you, right? And the way to get FOMO is sometimes you need social proof if you don't have quantitative proof.
Yeah,
you need somebody to see, oh, wow, okay, so that big name VC who I really like has invested in them. He's usually right. I'm going to follow his lead.
Like if Andreessen Horowitz has invested in it.
Yeah, or Sequoia or something like that. Yeah, there we go. Then you'll raise the rest of the round very easily.
Yeah.
So sometimes it's a little hard to get started, right? It's a little hard to get the momentum going.
Yeah.
In our case, we were lucky because we had professors from Wharton who we had a good relationship with for years because they had mentored us all through college.
Yeah.
And they were our first investors, actually.
Yeah.
Our first 200. Whoa. I think our first 400,000 US came from them.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and then the remainder of the round was a little easier to fill after
that. In fact, I have a favorite professor at Wharton, Adam Grant. Have you heard of him?
He's great.
Okay.
He's absolutely great.
Have you interacted with him?
I have interacted with him. I never
took
his class.
What are you saying?
Dude, I never took his class, but...
I love him.
He is great.
Give and take, this original...
Absolutely.
I think he's the god of cognitive psychology. And I think the youngest full professor ever, right?
You know, he was the subject of a big bidding war between Wharton and Harvard. And he was the youngest ever tenured professor at Wharton.
Exactly.
I think he got tenure at 29.
Yeah.
And he is, I mean, amazing. Like, his class is impossibly hard to take because it's so oversubscribed, right? Like, everyone wants to take...
Yeah.
I think what's
interesting about him is he spent 6 months of his life teaching and then 6 months of his life writing.
Yeah.
And he doesn't multitask. He says, I want to do one thing at a time and full in on it.
Yeah, it's a great approach. And more generally, I mean, the quality of professors that we had at Wharton is astounding to this day. I mean, I'm still amazed by the quality of professors and the people who I met when I was there. And that is the one thing that would bring me back to a university setting.
Absolutely.
It's just to get a chance to meet those people again.
Awesome. Okay, I know you to be an avid reader. I think before we started recording this, we were talking about Sapiens and Harari and other books around the evolution of humans. So what is one book that you would definitely give to a friend and why?
Oh, man. Okay, so is the friend Indian?
What would you give me?
So I would actually, I don't read much fiction, but I would give to you a fiction book, which is Midnight's Children by Salman Rushdie.
Okay.
I discovered this book when I was in my phase of sort of discovering India, right? Which is in class 8 or class 9. I mean, you read history and you study history because you have to do it, right? Like, I don't think anybody actually has an interest in doing it until a certain point. And I happened to stumble upon this book. It's a really, really well-known book. Multiple Booker Prizes and all of that. What's amazing to me about the book is how he imagined India in a fictional book in a way that nobody had done yet in the English language, right? That involved him creating this hodgepodge. The book is written in Hinglish, basically, right?
And
there's no punctuation. The sentences
just run on.
Isn't
this the book that attracted massive controversy?
That was his next one.
Okay.
Satanic Verses.
Satanic Verses.
Midnight's Children was still banned in India because it criticized the Indira Gandhi emergency.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was banned in India at the time. It's not banned now. Satanic Verses, I believe, still remains banned.
Yeah.
And it's not easy to pick up a copy of one of his books in India,
yeah.
But Midnight's Children is an absolute masterpiece. And for me, it's the book that made me fall in love with India.
Yeah.
It's a book I very religiously read once a year around Independence Day.
Really?
The book is also centered around the 15th of August.
Okay.
So it's not just for sentimental, you know, patriotic reasons. But the book really solidified for me what makes India a unique place.
Yeah.
And part of my decision to move back, I think, was heavily influenced by the fact that this book for me helped romanticize India in my head.
Yeah.
Whereas I think when we live here, it's easy for us to just get caught up in the squalor and the daily problems and not romanticize it enough to want us to live here. Sometimes,
absolutely,
you know, and sometimes there's just a feeling of escapism and I just want to get away.
I swear.
And
that is so true.
With Midnight's Children, like for me, all through college, all through my time away from India, because of that book, I think.
It reaffirms your love for the country.
Yeah, I was able to romanticize it, you know. And not that one should romanticize things beyond the point of seeing what's, you know, what's bad in them. I mean, it's the problems that we face day to day in India are very apparent and obvious.
Yeah.
But a little bit of that romanticism helps you fall in love with it when it's difficult too sometimes, you know.
Love it.
So
that
would be the first book I recommend.
Awesome. And one book you would recommend to not an Indian?
Oh, I have so many. I'm going to pull up my list.
Yeah,
because
sure,
I have a big list of books that I have read that significantly have...
How many books have you read so far?
Oh my gosh, I've lost count.
Really?
There was a long point when I was reading 1 to 2 books a week.
Yeah, wow.
And I've fallen off of that lately.
Do you audio it out or do you read books?
No, I read. I've never been able to get into audiobooks.
Yeah.
I've tried a few times, but I've never been able to get into audio. Okay, so I have a few books, right?
Yeah.
The first is a work of French philosophy called Simulacra and Simulation by this philosopher named Jean Baudrillard.
I'm actually looking at the list. It's beautifully categorized into fiction, philosophy, religion, design, history, physics, social studies, economics, business. That's a long list. Psychology.
It's a very long list.
Self-improvement, art, and then there's a bunch of other books to read. Wow.
Yeah. So this is books that have just influenced me significantly, right? Like, these are the books that I feel like have influenced the way I think in some way.
Yeah. So you were saying
Simulacra and Simulation.
Okay.
Which is a book by Jean Baudrillard, which talks about two concepts, right? So the simulacra is an imitation of reality, and a simulation is when the imitation imitates itself. So I'll give you an example, right? You have a play. The play is about a real life story. You make a play that's about the play, and then you make another play that's about the next play, and you keep going on that way.
It's like watching Inception.
Exactly. It is Inception, right? Like, and this is a book, this was written like in early 1900s, something like that. It is an impossibly difficult book to read for only being 100 pages long, but it goes into so much of how the world creates fictions that we all then collectively believe.
Imagined orders.
Yeah. And like, okay, here's a good example of this tangibly. The stock market, right?
Yeah.
And inflation expectations. If everybody thinks inflation is going to rise, inflation rises.
Yeah.
Right? And nobody really forgets, everybody forgets at the outset what led to this inflation increase.
It was the hypothesis of it.
Yeah. And so, perfect example, from 2 weeks ago, the US jobs report comes out and it says that wages grew by 2.9%.
Yeah.
Everybody thinks, oh man, wages are growing 2.9%, inflation is going to go up, interest rates are going to go up, stock markets are going to crash. Stock markets start crashing. People forget why they're crashing. 1 week later, nobody is talking about the fact that the whole crash is because of a slight early estimate number being a couple of tenths of a percentage point higher than expected. That's it.
Yeah.
And everybody forgets this. And it's just a marker of how much I think in life we are following imitations, as opposed to following what reality is, whatever objective reality might be. And that book has completely changed the way I look at the world.
But reading 1 to 2 books a week is insane. Tell me your reading strategy. How do you read? Do you read all pages, or do you skim through, or do you pick important chapters based on your Googling and then do it?
Oh, good question. So I think I fortunately read very quickly.
Okay.
And I tend to... I think a lot of people would call what I do skimming.
Yeah.
For me, skimming would involve reading a nonfiction book in like 2 hours.
Okay.
I don't think what I do is skimming, but I could think of a lot of people who would think that I'm skimming, which is you know, you read the topic sentences in the paragraph. If it's a well-written book, it's not that hard to figure out what the general meaning is.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, it's sometimes it's like you can tell if you hear a theory that you need a long explanation for, you read the explanation. If you hear a theory that makes instant sense, that fits in with some mental models you have of the world, you can skim it.
And after a point, most nonfiction books are saying the same thing, right? Just in different ways.
Yeah, sometimes. Sometimes. If you're staying within the same circles of subjects, for sure. And I think the more nonfiction you read, the better you get at identifying patterns of nonfiction writing. And once you identify those patterns, it's really fast to read them.
Concepts. Fair enough. I think another friend of mine who I had on the podcast recently on episode 3 or 4, his name is Rohan Rajiv. He's a very avid reader. So he says he measures books with a metric that he calls wisdom per page. And that is, if you remember one thing from a book that you've read in the past, that's great. But if you remember three, that's amazing. So that's how he measures books, what stayed with you and the wisdom per page. And
that. That's an interesting idea. I measure mine by how many Kindle highlights I have.
Oh, yeah? Okay, so you read off the Kindle?
I read off the Kindle. I read almost exclusively on ebook, except for fiction.
Okay. I've never been able to read off the Kindle for some reason. I like the physical copy. I do a lot of audio, though.
Hmm.
I like it. Just on my way to work, commute times.
Absolutely.
Cool. Last question, right? If you could put anything on a massive billboard for the world to see, what would it be? Jim Rohn says that you're the average of five people you spend most time with. Another famous athlete says that the world doesn't owe you a thing. What would you put?
Buy less shit. Minimalism. No, just minimalism. Okay, so one of my favorite TV shows is Mad Men, for the one thing that it had in like the third episode of one of the first seasons, where it says, one of the characters says to the other, man, is that true or did that just come from an ad? And I think so much of our desire for things is not driven by actual needs or wants. It's just driven by aspirations. Some of those aspirations don't need to exist.
Yeah.
To bring it back to simulacra and simulation, I think a lot of those aspirations come from an imitation of an imitation of an imitation. And we forget where the original aspiration came from. And we don't need to consume more of it. The mindfulness industrial complex, for instance, right? And meditation.
Yeah.
I think we all forget sometimes, but the amount of times we are inundated by messages today, especially in the Western world, saying, meditate more, breathe a few more times a day. This is the best life hack you can ever have. Like, the original point of meditation is not for you to get this, like, amazing sense. I mean, the side effect of it is that you get the sense of peace and calm, and you get a quote-unquote sense of wisdom about it.
Yeah.
The original point of meditation was to just see things as it is. Like, that is the reason for it, and it is deeply rooted in spiritual practice of Buddhism.
Yeah.
And people have just forgotten this. I mean, at this point, we are imitating the meditation that we see on apps, which in itself is a very poor imitation of some dude who went to Tibet and saw a Buddhist monk in peace. You know what I mean?
Sitting on the top of a cliff.
Yeah. So buy less shit. That's what I would say.
That's awesome. That's great advice. I think I've also been a huge fan of minimalism. In fact, my last year was experimenting on not buying anything for the year. Like, literally, I didn't stick through it, though, because I finally fell victim to one of the... I was traveling overseas and I needed to buy a couple of shirts just to look good on my first day of work. But
there we go. Why did you need to look good?
Simulacra and simulation.
Exactly.
Got it. That's minimalism is a great documentary that I would totally recommend.
It is a great documentary.
Have you watched it?
I have seen a little bit of it.
Yeah. Awesome. Great catching up, man. This is extremely insightful for me and for listeners and the rest of the guests that have been on the show. They know that I usually do podcasts generally to get smarter, and recording is just a byproduct. I guess it's everybody could use some inspiration or some learning and things that I'm interested in. I find, okay, I am interested in entrepreneurship. Ranju is kicking it there. Let's find out more. That's how this happened. So thanks for being on the show. Thanks for taking the time out.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.